The Supreme Court delivered two significant rulings today on the issue of voting rights. The court's conservative majority ruled against intervening in questions of partisan gerrymandering. They said electoral maps are not reviewable by federal courts, only state ones. Democratic leadership on Capitol Hill and several 2020 candidates have criticized that decision. In a separate case, the court temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census.
The Chinese are extremely worried that this is going to be another non-event where there really won't be anything agreed.
Everyone thinks the Fed is going to cut rates in July. Certainly the market is more than priced for a 25 basis point cut. Quite honestly, the discussion is not if they'll cut, but by how much will they cut.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, what a week it was this week on Wall Street. Lots to talk about on today's program. Expectations for Fed rate hikes coming in July. And of course, everybody's eyes in Japan. Will they or will they not reach a trade agreement? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray will join me as we talk about China playing the long game with the U.S. He also thinks it is a time to be defensive, and Craig is holding to his number by the end of the year. He thinks the S&P will be down from where it is now, at 2725. Dan Steffens will also join me as we take a look at the demand for energy rose at twice the average level, almost 3% last year. You wouldn't have known that if you looked at the price of oil. We'll also talk about those estimates being revised and great dividend yields in the energy patch. And in the big picture, we'll talk about catalyst and hedges, why you need to be hedged right now, and the broader implications of this trade war. It doesn't stop there. Global supply chains are being rerouted with bigger implications for the global manufacturing sector. All of that coming up in today's program. And a special note, you may have noticed we've streamlined our Saturday show based on listener feedback and input from you. So we've streamlined that into 1 hour to pack it full of a lot of information. Just want to say thank you for your feedback. Hope you enjoy it. We've had great feedback so far. And also Ryan Poplava will be joining in the first hour as we take a look at all those events shaping this week's market. All of that coming up in today's program.
This week has been a wait-and-see week ahead of the G20 meeting taking place this Friday and Saturday. That means Monday next week could potentially be an inflection point day in trading if President Trump and President Xi can come to an agreement to hold off on escalating trade restrictions and tariffs. Leading up to this weekend, we've been hearing from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, who recapped the U.S. was, is the key word, 90% away from a trade agreement in April, and Director of the National Economic Council, Larry Kudlow, who said the U.S. may move ahead with tariff increases and that there were no preconditions entering this weekend. So these comments, you know, there was nothing new. Our view is that if there is a surprise G20 trade deal, we think the areas to be watching on Monday morning would be semiconductors, commodities, the Shanghai Index, EU stocks, all of these areas would really benefit from any kind of a trade agreement or deal to de-escalate. If there's a hint a deal could happen this year, it will definitely be viewed as positive. Now, moving on. This week, there were some small catalysts to talk about, but from a top-down perspective, this weekend is the biggest potential catalyst, and that's basically over trade. Early this week, St. Louis Fed President Bullard said he thinks a rate cut is coming in July, but doesn't think a 40-point cut is necessary. That did a lot to temper the market's expectations, and the U.S. stock market closed negatively on the day. That was, I believe, Tuesday. The other hit that day came from White House officials who said the U.S. will not accept any tariff conditions, which may be a non-starter for the Chinese heading into the G20 meeting this weekend. So those two things take quite a bit of a wind out of the sails on Tuesday, but not too much. This week, AbbVie announced there was a $63 billion cash and stock offer to acquire Allergan. That's the maker of Botox. We are seeing large pharma essentially have become very concerned about their pipeline as some of their blockbuster drugs come off patent soon. Like if you look at AbbVie, their Humira drug is soon to be coming off patent. And then you look at Pfizer, Lyrica is also soon to be coming off patent. So those companies that we've seen a lot of M&A activity coming out of that area as companies are looking to essentially shore up their pipeline. So that's starting to cause some excitement in the biotech industry, and M&A activity as expected is expected to remain high throughout the year. In other company news, Micron topped consensus estimates for earnings and revenue for their personal third quarter, and they said they see signs of demand improvement and they expect DRAM demand to return to year-over-year growth in the second half of the year. Of course, we were hearing these kind of comments back in the first quarter, and that was seen as very positive for the industry, and we saw a nice rally in semiconductors back in March. They're also planning to reduce capital expenditures to help improve the industry's supply and demand imbalance. That's a key issue. Western Digital also announced this week some sort of power outage setting back its NAND flash capacity. So those two things this week set the semiconductor sector running nicely higher. Additionally, it's thought as a main beneficiary from any kind of trade agreement this weekend. So it was definitely bid up on that as well. On the economic side of things this week, the numbers weren't good, which plays into that not good is good for a Fed rate expectations. The Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model estimates that the second quarter GDP has dropped down to 1.5%. We'll hear next month the preliminary reading, and that's down from 2% about a month ago, so not so good there either. Personal income increased better than expected. That was a great increase. They're up about 0.5% month over month in May, while the PCE price index, that's another component where we take a look at, this study takes a look at price inflation. That's one that's actually very closely watched by the Fed. That dropped to 1.5% year over year from 1.6. Probably not enough to get the Fed to drop 50 basis points in July, but enough for maybe a cut of 25 basis points. Now, the June Chicago PMI fell to contraction territory. That's not so good. Down to 49.7 from 54.2. And there was a Texas manufacturing survey out as well, showing that June continued to drop. So it was negative 5.3 before June, now negative 12.1 on their scale. New orders for durable manufacturing goods fell 1.3% in May, mainly due to the transportation component. And on that note, Boeing discovered a new glitch in its 737 MAX plane this week, causing yet more carriers to cancel flights. Now, Southwest Airlines announced it will ground these planes until October 1st. So, you know, the 737 MAX problems aren't just affecting the Boeing. It's also been hurting some of the airlines, especially if you take a look at some of those stock prices. But the main catalyst right now, as I said earlier in the show, the G20 meeting this week, which kicked off on Friday. Already, there have been featured meetings between Prime Minister May and President Trump separately with Russian President Putin. The heavily featured topics will be increased tensions in Iran over the straits there, the U.S.-China trade war, and Chinese concerns over Huawei restrictions. Tune into the media this weekend, definitely, to learn more, as this will be a possible game changer for Monday's trading and a possible trading inflection point, one we're going to be watching very closely here. So U.S. markets will close early on Wednesday and be closed for trading for the whole day on July 4th, Thursday. I'll be back next week to give a short wrap-up for the short week, but I'll be happy to spend a little more time reviewing the market technical setup as we give our technicians and Jim a break. So Chris and our listeners, we'll see you next week.
We want to hear from you. We're inviting all of our Financial Sense NewsHour listeners to take our survey for a chance to win a free year subscription to FS Insider. Let us know what you think about our podcasts, and you'll be entered to win one of 10 free year subscriptions to FS Insider. All you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the banner ad to take our survey. This is open to all current and new subscribers.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
At this point, if we are in recession, we might already be coming out of it. And that's what the message of the stock market is. Maybe we had a 20% decline reflecting a mild recession, and we brought all this stimulus that you normally only get in recession, and you get a recovery out of that eventually again. So to me, whether it is or isn't, we would be doing the same thing either way that we're doing right now, is we'd be bringing a three-gun gooser, whether we were in a recession or not, and that would be the prescription to get out of it.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market has been in a narrow trading range over the last 18 months. We've seen new highs only to see the market retreat. We're now at higher levels. Will they remain? And is there anything on the horizon that could change the outlook? Joining us on the program from Piper Jaffray is Craig Johnson. Craig, when I interviewed you at the beginning of the year, everybody was extremely bullish. You were one of the more cautionary voices that we had on the program. In fact, I think your target for the end of the year was 27.25, if I recall. Are you still holding to that target, given the fact of where we are right now at 29.23?
Jim, thank you for having me back on the show. And in short, the answer is yes. I absolutely am still continuing to look for that 27.25 number by year end. And I got to tell you, as I go through, we've done this for a number of years. We've talked about this market being in a trading range of 2,900 roughly on the upper end, maybe 2,500 on the lower end. We still think that that is indeed going to be the case. And as I look at the internals of the market today, I got to tell you, Jim, they look worse today than they did in September of 2018. And 2018 looked worse than they were in January of 2018. So at this point in time, Jim, let me just put some numbers out here for the listeners. But as of this week, I've got 9 of our industry groups making a new high, 23 making new lows. I look at how many groups are in any form of an uptrend in our work, and it's 28% of our groups. If I break that down to individual stocks, I've got about a third of the entire market. And when I say entire market, that's every single stock above a 25 million market cap at a $2 price in any form of an uptrend in our work. And I've got about, less than half of all the stocks and our industry groups above a 200-day moving average. So the point that I'm making is we're pushing this market to new highs, and I've got very thin participation. That's a recipe very similar to what we had seen in September and also in January of last year. That makes me nervous, Jim.
And Craig, let's talk about some possible downside events or could be positive. Let's talk about what happens to the market if the Fed cuts interest rates next month. I've seen that some people say a quarter, some people say a half. But we did a show last week, Craig, and I think you'll back me up on this. When the Fed starts cutting interest rates, they're not doing that because things are going well in the economy. They're doing it because there's something they see that is troubling. So let's talk about the Fed. And the second one, which is plaguing this market and affecting global trade, is the trade war between the U.S. and China. So what if this weekend Trump comes back, they sign a deal. The only thing I see happening is just a personal opinion, is Trump agrees not to slap the 25% tariff and puts that on hold on the balance. But whether they walk away with agreement, I don't know. I just don't see it. But let's suppose that happens. Let's suppose the Fed cuts interest rates and they get a trade deal. What would that do to the market?
Well, Jim, let me break some of these pieces down first, because I think it's important to kind of put the context in this. First, if we go back, and we've done studies looking at Fed rate cutting cycles going back to the 1970s. And we need to ask ourselves, first and foremost, why? Ever since 2000, we've had two previous rate cutting cycles, 2001 and 2007. When I looked out 13, 26, or 52 weeks later, all three of those periods, we had negative returns for equities. Now, a lot of folks are coming back and saying, look at the history of rate cuts. Well, a lot of those rate cut cycles we had seen previously were happening at a much higher 10-year bond yield number than where we are today. So we were at a different point in the overall cycle. Remember back in 1980, we had 10-year bond yields and interest rates that were in the teens, and they've steadily now declined for the better part of 30 years. And we are now talking about rate cuts. And again, sub 5% seems like it's a much different response than what people had historically seen previously. So if we're cutting rates in here, Jim, I would agree. I look at rate cuts coming here at this point in time, and I have to ask the question, why are we cutting rates? The economy doesn't seem to be that bad. In fact, the jobs numbers seem pretty good. The GDP number seems pretty good that we had seen come out today. And we're cutting rates. So we got to put it into the context of why, and I'm not sure it's necessarily a good thing. Now, the second part of your question is, what if we get some sort of trade deal coming out of the G20 this weekend? I think the odds of it are probably small at this point in time. Maybe they're going to raise a tariff at a lower pace. But at this point, I think the Chinese are going to continue to take and play the long ball game with the tariffs at this point in time. And even if they do get an agreement here, I highly suspect that Trump will then turn his attention to Europe or somewhere else, India. So again, I don't think the trade war discussion is ultimately going away. But what I do find interesting is, I was getting ready for work this morning, we did see from Dow Jones that there was some sort of agreement or some sort of message that was being sent from Xi to Trump. And if we had tariffs removed on Huawei and other things and some basic tenets to an agreement, then that would ultimately be the basis of hopefully having something come out of the G20 meeting. However, if you watch the futures, the futures were positive before that announcement. So the thought is that we're going to get a trade deal. And all of a sudden, the future started weakening, Jim. And it felt like to me that the market really wants to see a future rate cut here coming in July. And if you get a trade deal, the odds of a rate cut probably go down. And I think the market itself is more interested in getting a rate cut than a trade deal right now.
So as we look at this, you said we're in a narrow trading range. Well, roughly 2,500 to 2,900. So let's move on to the next question. How long do we stay in that trading range? And like you said, if you look at the economy, it's slowing down, but it doesn't look anything like a recession. The only thing that it seems to be impacting is, like, for example, the ISM manufacturing survey, where service, which is not subject to a trade war, is doing much better. Do you just see us staying in that range over the next year or two, or do we break out or break down?
At this point in time, with where I'm seeing with the internals, I think we're going to be in this trading range right now, probably through the rest of this year. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, I got seasonality on my side from the perspective that historically, when we have seen the third year of a presidential cycle, we typically are strong in the first half of the year. Post the 4th of July, we tend to weaken into the second half. And under that kind of scenario, again, I think we're going to just kind of come back down into the middle of this range. I don't see necessarily right now a catalyst to have us break top side of this range. earnings numbers don't seem to be accelerating at this point in time. And with the uncertainty in the marketplace, I'm not sure that even if we're going to cut rates, that we're going to be putting an 18 or a 19 multiple on forward earnings in here. Now, Jim, you'd mentioned a recession. There's another little study that we had put together just in the last couple of weeks looking at the spread between the two-year yield and the effective Fed funds rate. And that yield has come in appreciably over the last, say, 3 to 6 months. Almost every single time, all but basically one going back to the 1980s, when we've seen that particular spread narrow the way it has, more often than not, it has led to a recession fairly quickly around the corner. So I think the economy's in okay shape, but the odds of a recession seem to be growing according to the bond market. And I think that's why the bond market is already priced in two rate cuts at this point in time and potentially part of a third.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things, and I want to spend just a few more minutes there. And that is, if you look at the bond market, yields have been coming down steadily since the beginning of the year. We're close down to 2% on the 10-year, while the stock market has gone right back up to that 2,900 level. It's almost like there's two different messages the market is giving us. And in my history in this business, I tend to follow the bond market tends to get it right more often than the stock market.
100% agree with you. History has always said that bonds lead equities, and we need to, I think, listen to that message. And I think once again here, I think that's what the smart money is doing. It's following what the bond market's lead is at this point in time. So my bet is that we still need to be probably a little bit more cautious. And again, I'm at a 27-25 year-end price objective, and I think this market's going to be coming back in. Am I taking a little bit of grief from some clients in sales and trading to a degree that they're questioning whether I can do simple math and the fact that we've already moved through our price objective? Yes, I am. But I am convinced that what I'm seeing with our work that we have done here at Piper Jaffray since the early 1980s is saying this is not the time to really start to go along this market in a big way. We need to be a little bit more reserved, take down position sizes, and play a little bit more defense and offense right now, because when I see the kind of internals we're seeing now, it is typically and historically not been a positive sign for markets.
You know, Craig, this reminds me of a story you once told me, and I think if I'm correct, it was in 2007. You were going around the office and telling all your analysts, hey, time to be cautious, time to be cautious. And they were looking at you like you were some idiot. And until 2008 really hit hard, are you getting some of that same pushback now?
I still am getting some of the same, you know, pushback. And, you know, that was one of my best indicators back then. You know, we had people on the trading desk, and I call this my spike indicator because the gentleman's nickname was Spike. He was bald, didn't have any hair, so I'm not sure why they called him Spike. But nonetheless, it was a great time in terms of sentiment. You know, toward the top of the market, it's Mr. Doom and Gloom. And when we got to the lows of the market, they thought for sure we're going to be fired and the market was going to fall appreciably lower in about February of 2009. And again, looking back at this, and it's like hindsight is, you know, perfect 20/20 vision, but the emotions back then were just running so raw back there in that February of 2009 timeframe. It doesn't surprise me. But yeah, I'm still getting some pushback on this. And there's a lot of people that basically say, Johnson, you're missing it. The Fed, the ECB, everybody is globally cutting rates. They have our back. Buy equities. Everything is going to be okay. And my point is, why are we cutting rates? Because I have to ask the question why we're cutting rates at this point in time. Because all I see from the economic data is things seem to be okay. But I guess we can't seem to quite get off of the monetary train that we've gotten ourselves onto. And I don't think it's quite so simple.
Yeah, well, you're asking a question we've been asking, you know, why is the Fed cutting interest rates? Basically, the best scenario for the market is when the Fed starts to raise interest rates, because that means the economy is booming, it's expanding. When they're cutting, they're doing it for an obvious reason. They see weakening or they see trouble in some area of the market. I want to talk about the S&P. And this sort of confirms what you think and what we're thinking. When you see areas like utilities, consumer staples, and REITs breaking out to higher levels and leading within the S&P versus the other groups like technology or industrials, you think two things. Is that one, a response to a fall in bond yields? Or number two, is it a response to a weakening economy? Or number three, a combination of both?
Well, I think ultimately when I see that kind of leadership in the market, it tells me that most portfolio managers are playing defense. And as we all know, portfolio managers have to be fully invested or near fully invested all the time. So what they can only do is sort of shift. They can play in more of a growth space. They can play more in a defense space. But Jim, when I come back and I look at where the best or where most of the new highs have been happening in this market over the last 26 weeks, it's gold and silver in North America. It's more of the utilities. It's more of the staples on a relative basis that have been making the new highs. So again, people are playing defense, and the pain trade clearly has been up as of the last, say, 30 days or so, as everybody is saying, market's going up, I got to play, I got to participate, and it's been kind of the FOMO trade all over again, the fear of missing out. Because people come back to me, Jim, and they'll simply say, Craig, I can't own cash. I have to be fully invested. I've got to be somewhere. And so you're seeing money moving up cap where there's more liquidity, and they're just trying to pick up some relative performance along the way. But that defensive mentality has kind of gotten people run over a little bit, and hence the pain trade is up and they've been chasing. And I think that that chase is where in the past we've seen some troubles emerge.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you guys do some great stuff. And once again, one of the things I've always admired about what you do, you're not afraid to state an opinion, even though it runs contrary to the crowd as you are today. How could they find out more?
Well, Jim, there's two ways. Number one, if they would send me an email, craig.w.johnson@bjc.com, I'm happy to have a conversation with them. And Jim, at least once a year, I participate in some of the public events like the Money Show. And they could certainly see me at the Money Show. We do some teach-ins there, too.
All right. Well, next time you're in California, stop on by and we'll go do Fogo de Chao again.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jim.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
If there's one thing that we know, it's that because the stock market value in household net worth exceeds that of real estate for the first time since 1968 and 1999, those are the only two times in U.S. history that households' holdings of stock exceeded those of their real estate. That means that the real economy is more sensitive than it has ever been to what happens in the stock market, and it can easily trigger a wave of layoffs that bleed into the real economy. So if the Fed decides to defy the market, then they're going to have egg on their face because they're going to have to rush in with emergency measures and even in between meetings.
Well, the price of oil seems to be heading higher, up in the upper 50s, well across 60 again, as global tensions mount in the Middle East. Joining us from Energy Prospectus is Dan Steffens. Dan, I wanted to cover a couple of things. The BP Statistical Review came out. It's kind of one of the key reports that come out in the energy business. You have the IEA World Energy Outlook in the fall, and then you have the BP Statistical Review. One of the things that struck me reading that report is despite all this talk about renewable energy, all the talk about a global slowdown, especially with the trade conflict coming from the U.S. and China, energy demand grew at its fastest pace almost double the normal rate for 2018. Let's begin with that, because if you were to look at those figures and what was going on in the oil market, it didn't reflect it, or at least it hasn't reflected that in the last 6 months.
Yeah, there's this, you know, belief that oil's like the old technology or something and demand's going to go down. But the thing is, as the BP report points out, just overall demand for energy, all forms of energy, relentlessly moves higher. And it moves higher just because you got growing global population and more people living in nations that are, you know, trying to increase their standard of living. And the only way you increase your standard of living is to use more energy. Now, we're going to need every kind of energy. I'm not saying oil and gas is the only thing, but, you know, picture this, a circle or the pie just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And even though green energy, wind, solar, geothermal, whatever, is going to increase, the pie is just growing so much that you're going to need more and more oil and gas based energy.
It's not just that, Dan. It's also, when you take a look at our modern technological society, we got all kinds of gadgets. I don't care if it's electronic watches, if it's our iPads, it's our phones, all the kind of things that we have today, that runs on electricity.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest areas for bringing electricity has been natural gas, but natural gas has not done that well.
Well, we're blessed to have an abundance of low-cost natural gas in this country. I mean, just 5 or 6 years ago, we were worried about running out and having to increase imports significantly. And then they, you know, horizontal drilling, fracking, really the, you know, breaking the code on how to drill and complete wells in Pennsylvania, Ohio, which is the Utica and Marcellus gas plays, is, you know, the most, one of America's greatest gifts from God is the Marcellus Utica, because it happens to be near our big population centers as well. And so you've seen this big increase in natural gas fired power plants, and the retirement of a lot of coal fired power plants. So natural gas is the bridge, to a cleaner environment, where you significantly reduce the amount of coal you're using for to generate electricity, and you use gas, because it's just going to take decades before, you know, wind and solar increase enough to, you know, really drive down the need for hydrocarbon-based energies.
Why do you think it is? Is it just because, let's say, energy is considered passe? Everybody talks about, you know, companies like Tesla, but Tesla isn't making any money. And I don't know too many car companies making electric cars that are. That's just number one there. Number two, you need an infrastructure to power electric cars. Although you do have some of the bigger companies like British Petroleum that are getting into electric charging stations here in California. It's not unusual to pull up to a hotel or even a shopping mall and see electric charging stations for electric cars. But Dan, we're a long, long ways away, and California is probably on the front line of that because of the environmental, well, almost environmental extremist in California. They've been shutting down the energy industry here, which means, here's the strange thing, the Wall Street Journal did an article, California is more vulnerable than any other state in the country to anything that goes on in the Middle East, because we're importing about 57% of the energy we consume here comes out of the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, I think one reason on California is too, because your fuel prices are so much higher than anywhere in the country. I mean, I filled up the other day for $2.19 a gallon. I don't think you've seen anything under $3.50 in California for quite some time, have you?
No, but they keep raising taxes.
Yeah, it's taxes, right.
And then they're going to do a blue ribbon panel to figure out why the price of gasoline goes up. I love it.
I know. I love it. They don't look at the taxes, half the cost of it in California. But I mean, it's all economics. I mean, for electric cars to become, you know, 50% of the total fleet, let's say, it's got to be economic. I mean, you run out of people that are just buying a Tesla just to be the cool guy on their block. It's got to make sense to the average person. And the other thing is, we're getting much better mileage out of our internal combustion cars. So there's constantly that competition going on. But then on the electricity side, 90% or 85-90% of the electricity to refuel a Tesla is going to come from a hydrocarbon fueled power plant, either coal or natural gas. So you're just shifting. Maybe it's helping, probably from the standpoint, from a pollution standpoint, it's helping because you're shifting away from a liquid fuel being burned for transportation to natural gas-fired electricity, which is cleaner. So that helps. But as far as reducing demand for hydrocarbons, it's not really going to do that much, even if half the people started driving electric cars.
Well, as you mentioned, if you have electric cars, you have to have electricity. What's going to be powering the electricity? It's going to be coal. It's going to be natural gas powered plants, because here in California, we've shuttered our nuclear powered plants. Mm-hmm. In fact, the irony is we're buying our energy from Arizona because Arizona has nuclear power plants. So once again, trying to figure out California's energy policy is crazy. Yeah. I want to move on to the stocks themselves, because if you look at within the S&P 500 or groups, energy has been probably one of the laggards, and has been that way for a while. You'll see a nice bounce. We had a nice bounce coming off the December 24th lows of last year. We get a peak, and then it's just down again. And by my recollection, Dan, in the last 2 years, we probably had four bear markets in energy, defining that as drops of 20% or more. And yet, you read the BP Statistical Review, you read the IEA Energy Outlook, demand is growing relentlessly. I don't care where it is, in the U.S., in China, in India. About the only place that's been stagnant has been Europe, but then again, their economies are stagnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we have two model portfolios of upstream companies, and one's kind of the mid-cap, large-cap companies that have couple billion to 50 billion market cap in there. They're all super high quality companies. They're all going to be profitable this year. If oil averages $55 for the year, they're going to be extremely profitable. And they're down 5%. I mean, the whole portfolio is down 5%. Now there's some that are up 20%, some that are down 20%, but they're all going to be profitable this year. And we're in much better shape today than we were at the beginning of the year. If you remember, oil, I think it was like Christmas Eve or the day after Christmas, got down to $42 a barrel. We were in the mid-40s to start the year. And here we sit $12, $13 a barrel higher. And these upstream companies, half of them are trading lower than they did at the beginning of the year. They're down year to date. My list, one of the things I look at is where do these companies sit in their 52-week range? And they're almost all in the lower quartile, if not at the very bottom of their 52-week range. And yet they're in much better shape than they were a year ago. So there's not much logic. And I think it's just, you know, the Wall Street gang just thinks of oil and gas as the old technology, and it's more fun to talk about Tesla, I guess. I don't know.
You know, speaking of companies that are making money, if you take a look at the cash flow and the dividend increases, some of these companies, and, you know, you take a company like Exxon, a big company, even companies like Exxon, I think they just increased their dividend 6% and 7%. And while Wall Street is ignoring this, according to insider reports, the big boys who run these companies are buying their stock. So insiders are buying, and I think for good reason, Dan, because if you take a look at a 10-year Treasury note, it's hovering around 2%. You can take, I don't care if you're looking at Chevron, Exxon, Royal Dutch, Total, all these big companies are offering dividends in the upper 4% all the way up to 6%. I'm just really surprising.
Yeah. You would think in a yield-starved market where people are looking for yield since their savings accounts are paying a quarter of 1%, that they'd really be looking at some of these companies. We sent out a report this morning on MPLX. I don't know if you saw it, but it is a very large midstream company, and it's heading into a merger right now. It'll be a $50 billion market cap pretty soon. It pays an 8% dividend, and they've raised their dividend for 25 straight quarters. And they publicly say they're going to raise their dividend 10% a year through like 2023. And you would think it'd be trading like crazy.
Now, what about some of the, I would say, originally the small companies that kind of started the fracking? Now you've got, as I mentioned, the big companies moving into the Permian and some of the other shale plays. Exxon, Chevron, all of them are looking to double or triple their production in the region over the next 5 years. What about the smaller companies, and what are the risks to those smaller companies, Dan, if, let's say, economy does slow down, or let's say interest spreads start to widen? I mean, these companies have been fortunate. They've been able to roll over their debt, and they've been able to get cheap financing in this low interest rate environment that we live in.
Well, in this business, in upstream oil and gas, size does matter. So that's something to look at. And it's a very capital intensive business, as you mentioned. I mean, these horizontal wells, you know, even the shallower ones are 3 to 4 million. And some of these deeper zones in the Permian, where they're going down 10 or 12,000 feet, and then they drill a mile and a half, 2 mile long horizontal section, those wells will cost $8 or $9 million to drill and complete. Now, they're going to produce 1 million barrels of oil, and, you know, multiply it by $50, that's $50 million. So these wells are going to pay out 3 or 4 times what it costs to drill them. But when you're looking at companies to invest in, I think the key today is you really need to take a hard look at the balance sheet. Are they generating enough cash flow to service their debt? Do they have liquidity? They all talk about their liquidity every quarter in the 10Q. You know, what's their cash flow? How does that match up with their drilling and completion budget? The big thing now is generating free cash flow. Are they generating free cash flow? I get that asked that question all the time. And there's some very high quality companies. I looked at Continental Resources. You know, that's Harold Hamm's company. They're not in the Permian at all. They're in primarily in the Bakken and in the Oklahoma, Central Oklahoma SCOOP/STACK plays. And they just announced $1 billion stock buyback program, a dividend, and the company's at $55 oil, they're going to generate well over $1 billion of free cash flow. So there's good companies out there trading at very low multiples right now. So,
yeah. Final question. One of the things that, you know, once again, we're talking about Wall Street and the logic. When the price of oil fell, as it did here recently, when we got up to the mid 60s, then it dropped down to low 50s. The refiners were sold off with a precipitous drop in price, and nobody's asking the question, wait a minute, I'm a refiner, the price of oil goes down, that means my input costs also go down, my margins increase. Mm-hmm. Nobody asked those questions.
Yeah, it seems like there's no logic in the analysis because, yeah, the refiners do benefit when their feedstock costs go down. And they also blend in a lot of NGLs. And, you know, in the winter, blend gasolines that can use more NGLs. We're now in the summer. So one reason gasoline prices go up in the summer is you have to use more black oil, more actual crude oil. And that adds 10 or 15 cents a gallon to the price. But their feedstock costs are down. Their margins should be going up. And you're in the part of the year, in the summer, demand for transportation fuels always goes up by about 1 million barrels a day. So you're in high demand period anyway. So, yeah, they should be doing well. I know I don't really follow the pure refiners myself.
I tell you, I love them because it's pretty hard to get dividend yields over 4% are going up double digits a year. Dan, given where we are right now, I mean, one of the nice things about the energy sector, wherever you look, you can get nice dividend yields. What would you be doing as an investor? Because there is that cloud on the market of trade deal. But as we mentioned, if there is no trade deal and the economy slows down, that might knock down demand by a couple hundred thousand barrels. It's still growing is the point.
Yeah, as long as we're increasing production and moving these things around, the last like 3 weeks I've been looking at midstream companies. I can tell you, Jim, I haven't seen the midstream business this good for decades, and it doesn't look like anything's going to slow down. The demand for gathering, storage, transportation, processing in the field, doing some minor separation at the wellhead, fractionation, whatever. The demand for those services is incredible. And there are some very high quality midstream companies that pay 6, 7, 8% yield. And a lot of them are MLPs, but recently there's been a lot that have converted back to C-Corps. I know a lot of your listeners don't like to own MLPs, or they don't want to own an MLP in an IRA account or something. But some of these like One Oak, O-N-E is that symbol. Plains All American, PAA is an MLP, but they have a tracking stock, PAGP, that is taxed as a C-Corp. You get that. And they raised their dividend 20% last quarter. And so there's some great, great buys out there right now.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, we're both bullish, still bullish on the energy sector. I can't believe the bargains that abound in that sector. If our listeners like to follow your work, you have a newsletter. You also have videos that you put out. Tell our listeners how they could find out more about what you do.
Yeah, we are a subscriber-based service. We have members all over the world, and we distribute our reports through emails. And then we also have a website where we store a lot of reports and forecast models. It's $350 a year to be a member, But if they will send an email to energyperspectus@gmail.com, that's energyperspectus, one word, gmail.com, we'll give them a promo code so they get $100 off their first year for being a listener to your show.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There are two major events that could impact the markets over the next month: a trade deal between the U.S. and China, and next month's Fed FOMC meeting, where it's widely expected that the Fed will cut interest rates. Now, we'll know this weekend the likely outcome of a possible truce on the trade war, or the trade war continues. And the result of this weekend may also impact what the Fed does next month. Just as our technician Craig Johnson has hinted, market internals are worse today than where they were last September. So today's big picture focuses on catalysts and hedges.
Well, Chris, why don't we begin with probably the story that the markets will be waiting with eagerness on Monday: what happens this weekend in Japan? So I want to focus on the trade war between the U.S. and China, as we are talking about the world's two largest economies. Now, despite what the White House says, it is impacting the economy, not just here, but also abroad. You take a look at world trade flows have sagged again in 2019, and if the president doesn't reach a deal this weekend, a 25% levy goes into effect on the remaining $300 billion in Chinese imports, which is, I don't care what he says, it's going to impact the shipping industry, autos, clothing, electronics, manufactured goods around the world. Now, according to CPB Netherlands, which is the Bureau for Economic Policy Analysis, goods moving across the borders fell 0.7% in April from March. April's trade flows show a decline in imports to the U.S. and a 5.3% slump in exports from Asia to developing economies, excluding China, of course. You're also starting to see signs of waning trade flows, and we see this here in California on West Coast ports. That's the main gateway for U.S. and Asia trade. They fell 5.3% in May, according to Bloomberg Economics. It's also weighing down on the airlines, with profit forecasts for the industry down by 21% in the first 6 months of the year. So trade is definitely impacting the manufacturing sectors of the global economies, and it is, at least in my opinion, one of the biggest factors weighing on the markets right now. You can see this reflected in the ISM Manufacturing Survey, which has recently fallen to 52.1, and some are expecting it to fall further when the June month numbers come out next month. And if it gets close to 50, you're talking about a manufacturing sector that's close to contracting. So global trade is being impacted much greater than what the politicians are telling us.
Restart the trade negotiations. The Chinese are extremely worried that this is going to be another non-event where there really won't be anything agreed. And President Trump is continuing to threaten to raise tariffs on the remaining Chinese imports to the U.S., which haven't yet been tariffed. So there's no question that he's got China's attention. And we know that some of the concessions that have been made by the Chinese negotiators in the course of the past year are meaningful. They're going to significantly increase, for example, their imports from the United States to reduce the bilateral trade deficit. And I think there will be meaningful changes. There will have to be meaningful changes, not only in terms of intellectual property rights, but also in terms of the Made in China 2025 strategy. So I think you can't deny that this is a much more effective approach to the China challenge than we've seen from previous administrations, not only the Obama administration, but the Bush administration before.
So, Jim, what are the expectations for this weekend? It seems like there's a lot at stake here. And do you think this is something that gets solved? How can we move on from here?
You know, at best, I think all you can expect this weekend is perhaps the 25% tariffs on remaining Chinese goods gets postponed to allow for more time for negotiations. But I believe the trade wars, Chris, are going to continue in one form or another, as there is a global backlash to globalization as more countries go back to protectionist policies and a return to many of the policies in the 1970s. There was a great article in the Wall Street Journal this week that says, you know what? 1970s revisited. And you can see this not only here with the presidential election, but it's also occurring in Europe, in Germany, the UK, Denmark, and Spain, where political parties are talking about reversing decades of pro-market policy promising greater state control of business and the economy, more welfare benefits, bigger pensions, higher taxes for corporations and the wealthy. In the UK, the Labour Party is talking about renationalizing public utilities, the Postal Service, and the Royal Bank of Scotland, basically undoing Thatcherism. In Germany, they're talking about seizing real estate from commercial landlords as a way to stop rent increases. As one analyst noted, the era of globalization and liberalization and our free markets are going to become less free and more under the control of the government.
Well, this doesn't sound healthy for the economy, whether it's here or abroad. So in your opinion, who do you think blinks first? Do you think it's the U.S. or China?
You know, if there's a blink, I believe it's going to be on the U.S. side. You know, President Xi Jinping doesn't have to worry about re-election, as does President Trump. And just like the Iranian oil sanctions, China is skirting around the trade tariffs. Goods subject to tariffs are dodging tariffs by entering the U.S. via other countries in Asia, especially Vietnam. Exports to Vietnam from China of electronics, computers, machinery have increased substantially, and exports from Vietnam to the U.S. of those same goods have increased by almost 72% in the first half of the year. Also, Asian exports from countries other than China are up over 54%. So China has figured out a way to skirt the tariffs by re-exporting its goods from other countries.
So I know at our firm, you're monitoring economic data. It looks like economic activity is softening, and really that might be one of the reasons the Fed has done a 180-degree pivot this year. But last week, we discussed auto plants and steel plants shutting down, with layoffs showing up in the manufacturing sector. Jim, what other signs are you seeing, though, that do point to a slowdown?
You know, we're seeing a slowdown in factory activity around the country. The Dallas Fed's manufacturing index fell to the lowest level in 3 years in the month of June. Trade tensions are clouding the outlook for factories, with 41% of Texas manufacturers saying U.S. and foreign tariffs are having a negative impact on their business. And it's not just the Dallas Fed. The Dallas survey follows soft reports coming from the New York Fed report, the Philadelphia Fed surveys as well. And we even had high-frequency economics Jim Sullivan. He believes the June ISM Manufacturing Index is tracking at close to 50.8, which is his prediction. That's barely above contraction. Anything below 50 or below indicates the factory sector has gone into a recession, or at least is contracting. So if it dips below 50, Chris, I would expect the Fed would react to a contracting manufacturing sector, which could be a harbinger of an approaching recession next year. And it just isn't manufacturing that is contracting. It's also CapEx spending by business. Now, the idea, if you go back to the tax bill that was passed in 2017, went into effect last year, the idea, 75% of those tax benefits went to corporations. And as many of you know, I've not been a big proponent of this tax bill. But anyway, the idea was if companies were saving money on taxes, well, they would update old machinery, they would hire more workers, they would expand into new markets. Well, it worked initially. At least last year's CapEx spending by business rose roughly about 11%, but has started to wither this year, slipping to only 3%. Now, even though the tax cuts raise profits, the reason CapEx is fading because of concerns over global growth, trade tensions between the U.S. and China, the disruption of the global supply chains, as we're hearing more and more announcements from companies like Apple to others who are basically relocating manufacturing facilities outside of China. So you know what that tells me, Chris? Companies plan long term. And when you're taking a factory out of China and you're relocating it to another location, you expect this not to be a one-time event that's over soon, but something that continues. So the trade war is becoming very disruptive to CapEx spending. Instead, companies are choosing to use the tax savings for share buybacks. And just as an example of that, last year, share buybacks were $860 billion, which was a record. In the first quarter alone, share buybacks were $205 billion. So when you have companies spending as much as they are doing now in share buybacks, it tends to reflect a dearth of new ideas for growth, which is probably another sign of a slowing economy. Now, if the economy was booming, they would be spending money on CapEx, not buybacks. And it isn't just companies. It's consumers. The latest consumer confidence survey from the Conference Board slipped to 121.5 in June. That's down from 131.3 in May. These are just, Chris, a few of the anecdotes that point to a slowdown underway, which explains why the futures markets are expecting a rate cut from the Fed next month.
You pointed something out last week, and even today with Craig Johnson, that when the Fed begins to cut interest rates, it's not a sign of good things coming. Usually it's a sign of trouble ahead. So, Jim, let's bring this back to investors listening to the program. What do you do now? Paint a best case scenario and a worst case scenario and how to hedge against both.
You know, as we've been saying since the beginning of the year, this is a market where you cannot be all in unless you're, an adept trader. I mean, there are technicians out there that are very good at trading in and out of the market. So you have to be partially defensive in case no trade deal is reached, or it's just, for example, what I expect, a postponement of additional levies. Now, the best case scenario is a trade deal is reached, the levies are postponed, and the Fed cuts interest rates next month. In that case, it's time to deploy capital into the markets for what is one last hurrah, because these trade wars are just the beginning of the protectionist movements around the globe and a reversal of the trend towards globalization that has driven economics these last four decades. Now, the expected scenario is they just dial back the rhetoric, postpone the additional tariffs, and agree to pursue further negotiations. That's probably the more likely case. The worst case scenario is they walk away, no agreement is reached, which could be bad for the markets. It's probably one reason why you need to be hedged right now is so much of what is going to happen is political, and it's dependent on tweets, press conferences, which have markets moving in packs. In fact, everywhere you look, markets from stocks, bonds, currencies are moving in tandem more often as central bank surprises and trade uncertainty assert a grip over the markets. We can go from, and we've seen this play out over the last 18 months, one of the reasons the market's in a trading range, we go one day we're on the risk-on market, the next day we can have a tweet, something happens, we're risk-off. Very easily with just, you know, when you think about it, a simple tweet or a Fed governor giving a speech.
So based on that, what happens now?
Hell if I know.
All right. Well, that's our show.
Yeah, seriously, I'm probably not the only one that's probably saying that right now. No, I mean, we're all playing a waiting game. I don't believe we'll have answers to trade wars completely this weekend. Even if there's a ceasefire, rivalry between the U.S. and China is going to be ongoing. As I mentioned earlier, protectionism is growing globally, and you take a look at the complex supply chains that have been in existence for decades are now in the process of being reversed as companies begin to learn to deal with trade friction. I mean, if you have a factory and you're operating in China, you probably put it there because it was cheaper to make or build things. Well, what happens if the goods you ship out of China have a 25% tariff? There goes your sales and your margins. So companies are dealing with this. The other factor is, if you take a look at the markets, they really aren't cheap. The economies globally are slowing down, as we have pointed out and others have on this program. And the reason central banks globally are cutting rates, not to mention that socialism is on the rise here in the U.S. and especially in Europe, which, Chris, isn't good for the economy or the financial markets. So right now, the markets are pushing interest rates down, and they're a big bet. Rate cuts are coming our way. But what if the Fed hesitates, for example, if there is some sort of trade deal and, let's say, the markets rally? So there is a reason to be cautious right now, which is why investors should be hedged. And that would include cash, treasuries, gold. And I would say if you're in the stock market, defensive dividend type stocks. If Craig Johnson is right, and he usually is, a 27-25 year-end target for the S&P would imply a 7% decline from here, and it would be not too good probably in the second half of the year, because that's when everybody's expecting the markets are to pick up. Now, if you look at the market since 2018, as Craig talked about, we've been in a trading range the last 18 months. I would not expect that to change and actually become more volatile next year, being an election year. As we discussed in our 2019 forecast, one of the risks we discussed was politically, which we're seeing play out with the trade war, and also in Washington, where it looks like Democrats are choosing to investigate rather than legislate, which leaves, really, only the Fed to stimulate the economy if the slowdown we are seeing now continues, which it looks like it will do.
Well, I think everyone thinks the Fed is going to cut rates in July. Certainly, the market is more than priced for a 25 basis point cut. Quite honestly, the discussion is not if they'll cut, but by how much will they cut? Will they move by just 25 basis points, which is our expectation, or could they make a larger move and actually cut by a half of a percentage point? There was one of the speakers, one of the FOMC voters yesterday, Governor Paul, not Governor, but Bank President Paul, who Bullard, excuse me, who is among the most dovish, who seemed to downplay his own feeling about making the larger 50 basis point rate cut. And the markets actually were disappointed by that. So you can see this market is certainly anticipating a rate cut next month. And again, I think that it'll be validated. It's just a matter of by how much.
So in short, we could see a catalyst as being the best outcome with a ceasefire on the trade front and the Fed cuts interest rates. Now, in that case, we could see one last hurrah in the markets. On the other hand, if things don't play out like markets expect, well, then expect volatility to pick up as they move in tandem. So you do need to be hedged. So Jim, given all the uncertainty that's floating in the air, what do we do next? What do you see on the horizon?
Well, the big one's going to be this weekend. The markets will be weighted with bated breath on Monday to either buy or sell, depending on the outcome between China's president and President Trump. So that's a big one. And then also, depending on the outcome of that, we also have the FOMC meeting coming at the end of July, on July 31st. The other thing, too, is we're going to have a whole slew of economic reports coming in. The first half of the year is over here shortly. So we'll be looking at corporate earnings and see if this economic slowdown in the PMIs continues. As I mentioned, High Frequency Economics expects the ISM manufacturing number to dip down to around 50, which is borderline heading into a contraction area. And then, of course, we have second quarter earnings, which kicks off in just a couple of weeks. We'll be here to talk about it, as we hope you will. In the meantime, until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.